I want to do a couple of things in this session. One is look at the whole concept of memory a little bit objectively in terms of the research, and then subjectively, based on a fascinating book I read many years ago. And then we're going to do the part about ethics, which is rather unorthodox. Of course, working in this field is generally unorthodox. Because what I want to do, you know, I have said already repeatedly that treatment needs to reverse the dynamics of abuse. And so part of what I want to do in that section is take you into what it's like to be abused. Because if you don't understand that, you won't know how to work with victims. And then look specifically at some of the ethical guidelines and things like that that are based on the experience of abuse and what it does to people. So we did phase one. Phase two is generally the memory work. So you've got somebody who has a safe relationship with you, who has some stability, not just with you, but in their lives, and whom you have taken through some of these interventions and skills so that when they dysregulate, they don't trash themselves. Because when they deal with the memories, that's when they dysregulate the most, obviously. Many clients will come in at the beginning and say, I just want to tell you the story and get it over with because then I'll be better. Well, that's actually not true, and so I don't let them. That's one of the places where I draw a pretty firm boundary. Just say to them, we need to prep. You know, it's like prep for surgery. If we don't prep, it's not going to turn out well. And so I explain to them what the first phase is about and why, and I know there's urgency in telling the story. So, you know, you have people who never want to tell you the story and get better anyway, and you have people who want to tell you in the first 10 minutes of treatment and then feel better, and then you have everything in between. And so constantly educating them about the process and why we're doing it the way we are and how it's protective and helpful to them is necessary. So in dealing with memories, and this is probably the phase where the most mistakes are made by therapists, is phase two. The memories can be overwhelming, not just to the client. They can be very compelling. We battle with doing the same things our clients do, leaving in various ways, numbing, telling ourselves it can't be true, distancing ourselves emotionally from our clients, and we'll talk about some of those things later as we talk about vicarious trauma. Or it's so compelling that we become grandiose and messianic and trash our boundaries. I've worked with a lot of people through the years who have had that experience in therapy. So understanding that this phase is the most vulnerable for a client and therapist is very important, and what the boundaries need to be and how to manage the experiential part both for the client and yourself. So there are two ways to think about memory, and both are very important to this work. The first is objective. You know, what does the research say? Just some thoughts about it. Number one, there is research showing evidence for delayed recall of trauma after a period of forgetting. You know, there's all kinds of stuff out there about false memories and everything else. But there was a study in 94 and 97 where the researcher followed up on both men and women who in the 1970s were seen in a hospital emergency room for child sexual abuse. They found that at the time of their study, which was 17 years after their visit to the ER, 38% of the women and 55% of the men did not recall the documented abuse. Of the women who did recall the abuse, 16% said there was a time in their history where they did not remember that it had happened to them, but now they remembered. When people report that they recall childhood trauma previously forgotten, clinicians and researchers have been interested in the factors that relate to delayed recall and the accuracy of such memories. Research suggests that age at the time of the trauma is associated with forgetting. We mentioned that a little bit earlier. Those who are younger, who have only primitive mechanisms for coping with anything, are more likely to forget and remember later. Interestingly, the majority of recovered memories, so-called, occur outside of therapy. The vast majority of them. I forget what the percentage is. Regarding the accuracy of those memories, several cases in the public record of delayed recall of abuse provide evidence of accuracy. So there have been situations where people didn't remember and then did, and it was documented earlier, and so they could compare what they remembered to what had been documented. In the study I mentioned before about the people in the ER, he was able to compare current accounts with the details that had been recorded in the emergency room in the 1970s. So this is 20 plus years later. And found that those recovered memories had the same number of discrepancies when the ER accounts were compared with those 17 years earlier. So in other words, none of us remembers perfectly about anything. But the discrepancies in the recalled memory and the discrepancies in the ER documents, in terms of what actually happened, were the same. Evidence suggests that memories of childhood trauma can become accessible after a period of no recall. It also suggests that certain situational and personal characteristics, like if somebody was more dissociative as a child, more imaginative, whatever, can have delayed recall. But the other thing is that clients that are more dissociative or have a strong imagination who have been in unethical ways asked to form mental images and all kinds of things in therapy end up with the therapist maximizing suggestibility. And so then you have a small percentage who then report what's not a true memory. So it's again, it's very important in this place to know what the ethical guidelines are and what the boundaries are. Because on the one hand, you want people to be able to tell you what actually happened. On the other hand, you don't want to help them tell you something that didn't happen. And so it's a bit of a tightrope. Now, the other way to think about memory is subjectively. And years ago, I read a fascinating book by a man named Lawrence Langer, L-A-N-G-E-R. I think it was in 1991 it was published. It's called Holocaust Testimonies, The Ruins of Memory. And he talks about memory in this book and says that memory continues to function in the mind whether it's given speech or not, which we know that because we see symptoms in people even though they have not told the story. So he says that since memory cannot be silenced, really, it might as well be heard. And the point is that whether memory is spoken internally or externally, it continues to impact and shape a life. It speaks through symptoms even when one does not consciously remember the cause of the symptoms. The experience of telling, he says, requires risks from all participants. That would include you. Survivors struggle to discover voices trustworthy enough to truly tell their story. Remember, we're speaking the unspeakable. Their urge to tell meets resistance from the certainty that nobody who's listening will ever absolutely understand. And there's some truth to that. However, to assume others cannot understand underestimates the sympathetic power of the imagination. So it's time, says Langer, to grant the power of imagination the role that it deserves. It is also in the telling that the opportunity is given for the witness, which would be us, to serve as both pathologist and physician. So we are diagnosing disease and working in a way that's healing for that disease as we bear witness to what we're hearing. He speaks to the issue of the reliability of memory on which testimonies must draw both for accuracy and intensity. How credible can a reawakened memory be that tries to revive events that are decades old? He says the terminology is at fault. There's no need to revive what never died. Traumatic memory has an insomniac faculty, mental eyes which never sleep. He says that's why such memory impacts a life, whether it is consciously held or not. Testimonies regarding trauma are human documents. They're not just historical documents. factual errors or simple lapses occur from time to time, but they are not important in comparison to the impact that the events had on the human being. And that's part of the essence of the whole complex trauma dialogue. This is about the impact on the person, the child, who is being traumatized, and in his case, those who lived in the death camps. So he has all different kinds of memory he talks about in his book. I just want to touch on a couple and give you some quotes from the Holocaust survivors, because it is fascinating how alike it is to survivors of sexual abuse. It's also true that the language, of course, is different than the classic language of therapy or working with sexual abuse, and I find it very helpful to learn about the same thing from a different kind of voice. It's like a different ray of light coming in that helps us see better. So the sexual abuse literature, of course, is full of the language of abuse and psychology and all that stuff. To read about double selves and splitting in psychology or abuse literature is one thing, but to read about it in the context of the Holocaust sheds a different light and affirms what we see with survivors of sexual abuse. So as you listen to the terms on the quotes from the Holocaust survivors, they will sound familiar, but they will also clearly demonstrate how trauma divides the self. It's part of the essence of what it does, the me and the not me, or my life and not my life. One of the kinds of memory he talks about, he refers to as deep memory. Endeavors to leave it behind are futile. Whether you remember consciously or not, it's in there and alive. Here's someone who was in Auschwitz. They said, "I live beside it. It is right there, fixed, unchangeable, wrapped in the impervious skin of memory that separates itself from the present me. I wish the skin would become tougher, because I fear sometimes it will grow thinner and crack, permitting the trauma to spill out and recapture me." This is another person who was in Auschwitz. "I live a double existence. The double of Auschwitz doesn't mingle with my present life, as if it weren't me at all." So you can hear that splitting. This is me here. I'm married. I have children. I live in the United States. I do these things. That's not me, Auschwitz. It's very common in survivors of sexual abuse. Another quote, "Sometimes it bursts and gives out its contents, and I feel it again physically." I'm sure you've had that experience with trauma survivors who will talk about what they feel in their body as if it were happening. So this is a Holocaust survivor saying the same thing. "I feel it again through my whole body. It takes days for everything to return to normal and the skin of memory to heal itself." So deep memory, he says, is the old isolated memory of the trauma, and it burrows underneath, and sometimes the cover cracks and it spills out into life. Common memory, which all of us have and are familiar with, is present. It helps restore the self to normal when the trauma memory bursts out. So there are two adjacent worlds, but the trauma memory periodically intrudes on the common memory. Survivor recounting her life in the death camps. "Do you understand what I'm trying to tell you?" How many times do we hear that from survivors? Which acknowledges the limited power of words, which we must affirm. Words have to be used, but they don't quite capture it. A vast sphere separates what was endured from our capacity to absorb it. The survivor is remembering what was. The listener is imagining what was. Never forget the difference. Respect it. Another kind of memory is anguished memory, and this has to do with some of the dissociation, which is prevalent in concentration camp survivors. He uses the term to refer to memory that assaults and ultimately divides the self. So, you know, they talk about splitting themselves. Wasn't me, it just wasn't me, I was somebody else. A survivor of a camp. "In order to survive, I had to die first. And you hear this from survivors of child sexual abuse. To me, I was dead. I died. I didn't want to hear nothing. I didn't want to know nothing. I didn't want to talk about it. And I didn't want to admit that it happened to me. Sound familiar? Another one. My head is filled with garbage. All these images, you know, and sounds. And my nostrils filled with smells, and you can't cut it out. And it's like another skin beneath skin, and you cannot shed it. I am not like you. You have one vision of life. I have two. I live a double life. Another one. There's a sort of division, you know, a compartmentalization of what happened, and it's kept tightly separated, and yet it isn't. It must not interfere. It must not become so overwhelming that it makes my normal life unable to function. He talks about humiliated memory, and this is the memory that is so laden with shame, which is a huge issue among survivors. The utter distress that shatters all the molds that one had of a unified, irreproachable self. It is the memory of things done that makes being dead preferable to being alive. The impact of such memories is not limited to those who endure the events, but can also be felt by those who hear about the events. Knowledge of abuse leads to unflattering views of human nature. And we are very tempted as counselors, as Christians, to interpret people's past in such a way so that we can hold on to our positive beliefs rather than confront their undoing. You know, we say we live in a fallen world, but we don't want to look. We want to erase the opposition between what we hear and what we want to believe. That's why institutions cover it up. That's why we do this. The memories leave victims inhabiting two worlds, one of choiceless choice, which is a phrase that comes out in the book and the movie Sophie's Choice. I don't know how many of you ever saw that years ago. But it's a woman, a mother, who was taken to one of the death camps, and you know how they get in lines for gas ovens and whatever work. And she had her two children with her, and she had to pick which one goes to the oven and which one stays alive and works. That's a choiceless choice. If any of you work with trafficking victims, prostitutes, they live lives of choiceless choice. The vast majority of them were sexually abused when they were children. They usually are on the streets by age 14. Pimp finds them, sells them. People say, well, why don't they just leave? You know, having a choice means I can do this thing, or I can do this thing. But if this thing isn't on the table, like have my own apartment and go to school and do all, there is no choice. So it's very important to understand this concept of choiceless choice. And we in the West don't get it very well. You know, we're all independent. We make up our own minds, responsible for our own lives, and well, some of us. One survivor talks about gradually you become a different person and you do things you would never think you would do. So survivors do things antithetical to who they see themselves to be. If you read the Holocaust literature, you read about sons stealing their father's bread. And then they live with this humiliated memory. But they stole the bread because they wanted to live. They didn't want their father to die, but they wanted to live. You hear this with victims of sexual abuse who've been forced to abuse a sibling because if they don't, something will happen to them. Their life is threatened or whatever, or forced to kill their own pet or whatever. Choiceless choices that carry shame all the way down to their toes. You know, that it's the place where, and of course, as the adult later looking back, the question is, how could I do that? But this person can't assess that child. They judge themselves as evil, as cowards, and all of this kind of stuff is so alien to what self-reliant Western minds think. Humiliated memory dwells in twilight. It's a place where ethical insight doesn't illuminate very clearly. It's not a black and white area. And the survivor's sense of agency today contrasts sharply with the memory of the powerlessness and the things chosen then. So if you're going to walk into memories of chronic trauma, you're going to encounter these kinds of memories, anguished, deep, humiliated. It means dealing with content and searching for forms, because whatever forms you have now, they won't fit. Memories defy the normal categories. It's not just about speaking the unspeakable, it's about bearing witness to the unspeakable. It's about explaining the unexplainable and bearing the unbearable. So, I want to take you into what, if you have somebody sitting across from you in your office, and you know they have a history of child sexual abuse, let's say chronic, I want you to get who they are. Because if you don't get who they are, you'll make bad decisions, you'll make unethical decisions, well-intentioned, compassion, heart, bad decisions. I've worked with all kinds of trauma all over the world. So I think between all kinds and, you know, sexual abuse, rape, domestic violence, military sexual assault, genocide, trafficking, there's probably more. It's quite a menu. And cross-culturally. So I think that what I want to give you today is what I see as the basic characteristics of trauma that pretty much cut across everything. Those you need to understand. And how it shapes people. And if we don't understand these things, again, we will be well-intentioned, we will love people, we will have hearts of compassion, and we will hurt them. And they're already really hurt, so we don't want to do that. I've seen many clients over the years who have seen other therapists and been injured in the course of that treatment, not on purpose. But the counselors were not even aware often that the client had been injured. And it usually occurred because knowledge of trauma is not sufficient for good treatment. Now, we talked about PTSD. We've talked about complex trauma. You need the knowledge. If you don't have knowledge and pursue knowledge for the clients that you're working with, you're going to do stuff that's unethical. You have to be informed. But knowledge is information. And information, I don't think, adequately opens the door to the experiential world of the trauma survivor. We know this. You know, you can read about another country and culture, and yeah, I consume books before I go to another country. But when you get there and you're on the ground and you're with the people who live there and you stay in their homes and you eat their food and you hear their stories, it's a whole different learning. Same thing with our clients. You can consume, you come to seminary and consume tomes on Christianity. You could even be articulate in presenting all that knowledge and yet never really know the relational experience of loving and following and obeying Jesus Christ. We know people like that. So I want to take you through some very basic ways about how trauma affects human beings. Again, they're pretty universal to the different types. We're speaking particularly, however, here today about child sexual abuse. And the emphasis there, the major factor there is, which is different from, say, growing up in a healthy home and living in a country that has genocide in it, it's because the trauma is part of the shaping and developing of the child. So there's a uniqueness to child sexual abuse. And again, I don't want us to just understand it intellectually, though we must do that, but also experientially. And it's not just experiential in terms of who the victim is now in our office. We need to understand their experience as an adult. But the child who was abused is in our office too. The victim brought that person with them. And we need to understand what it was like to be that child. We need to know how to enter in as if we had experienced that abuse. All the while remembering that we stand here and are bearing witness to someone else. It's a very thin line. So You have therapists who don't want to enter in because who wants to swim in a sewer? Who wants to deal with the questions it's going to raise about your faith or the church or this or that or anything else? So we hesitate to enter in. On the other hand, you have therapists who enter in so much they forget it's not their life. And the boundaries go out the window and they end up all involved in doing all sorts of bad things or just harmful things. So we're entering in as if we, knowing it is in fact not ours. That's true for all of therapy, of course, but when you get to intense things like this, it's more difficult. So it's a great tension, entering in so as to understand through both knowledge and experience, and yet all the while remaining grounded in ourselves and our lives. I am not this person. I want to understand and enter into this person's life, but I am a separate person. So first of all, we need to grasp what it is we're discussing. Again, the term child sexual abuse, child sexual trauma has been used so frequently that many of us who work with victims are so used to hearing it, we don't even really process the term anymore. It's just this thing that goes by. It's easy to skip over the real meaning. There's danger in that because the real meaning was lived by the person across from us. We can't forget that. So we're sitting across from somebody who was assaulted. Let's use that word instead of abused. Often repeatedly. An assault is an attack, not necessarily violent or brutal. It's a beating, sometimes on the body, but certainly on the mind and the soul. It can cause bodily harm, but it causes all sorts of other harm as well, to the thinking, to the heart, to relationships, all of that that we've talked about. And the victim in this situation lives in constant fear or anxiety that something bad will happen again. Is it here yet? What did his face mean when he did that? I think that means it's going to happen soon. I don't know what to do. Why is he taking so long? I know that tone of voice. I know it's going to happen tonight. I wish it would just happen. I'm terrified it's going to happen. That's the voice of the waiting, terrified child. That's how they live. It's also often the voice of the adult they become. So they sit across from you and say, what did that facial expression mean? What's that tone of voice? Are you going to hurt me? And you're sitting there thinking, what the heck did I do? Second, the assault is happening to a child who is by definition limited, dependent, vulnerable, malleable. And it's not only reoccurring, but it's often the same assault over and over and over again. So suppose somebody in your life came up and kicked you in the gut with a large, heavy work boot with steel toes. You would be injured. You would be confused. You would be bruised, and you would be sore for a long time. Now, suppose that person had access to you in such a way that they kicked you again and again and again and again in the same place for years. The kick, so-called, of sexual abuse to the child is, of course, excruciating in physical ways. But it is also emotional, relational, mental, spiritual, and impacting development again and again. So it's like kick, bruise, shape. Kick, bruise, teach. Kick, bruise, lies over and over and over and over at age 5, at age 15, at age 18. Now, if you let yourself feel what I just did, you want to go like this. It makes us want to shrink away. That's what the child wanted to do and couldn't do. They want to shrink away from you in the therapy office. That's why I say I've never met one who wasn't courageous when they showed up. Because that's what they expect. They want it to stop. We want it to leave. Let me stop this. Assaults, no matter how grown up or mature we are, make us little. If you've ever cared for a dying parent, you know that the assault of death renders them, though once vibrant, strong, and even wise, limited, dependent, and vulnerable. if you've ever been assaulted, and I don't mean by a person, but let's say in a major car accident, or had major surgery, or lived through a ravaging disease, you know the experience of being reduced, of feeling little in the doctor's office, feeling needy, being dependent and vulnerable because you couldn't take care of yourself for a while. In child sexual abuse, not only does the child stay feeling little or reduced, which if you think about it in the context of the developmental trajectory is absolutely the opposite of what's supposed to happen. They're supposed to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But they feel little. They continue to feel little everywhere they go, even if they're 30 and brilliant, or 50 in the CEO of a major corporation, or in the position in a Christian ministry of a global community, or sitting in a room with a closed door across from somebody who is a therapist and says, I'm safe and I can help. But they still feel that little, needy, vulnerable, dependent, and so all the defenses come up. Third, I'm sure many of you in this room have had some experience of a physical assault in your life. You've broken a bone. You've had major surgery. You've lived through labor without anesthesia. You've been in an accident. What's the most dominant thing on your mind when the assault on your body occurs and following? Pain. It takes over everything else. It manages your life and your time. It feels unbearable, and the thing you most want above anything else is just for the stuff to stop. When we are in pain, most of our energy goes to ways to make it stop. We figure out how to sit or move our body so it doesn't hurt as much. We take pills. Sometimes we take too much. The task consumes who we are because the pain cannot be stood. As a child in pain, your options are very limited. You have few resources, little knowledge, no support, and no physical strength. And again, in many cases, you are dependent on your abusers to feed and care for you. Those who should, in fact, rescue and protect and comfort you are the very ones kicking you in the gut with a steel-toed boot. The betrayal is enormous. So you are left as a little person with whatever you can find internally, which is not a lot. You haven't had time to put many things in there. You need an oasis. So how are you going to get that when you're being repeatedly abused? If you don't get it, you're going to go nuts. You have to find a narcotic. You have to find a way to numb the pain because that's the only thing that's screaming at you. You have to find a way to self-protect. You have to find a way to leave. Whatever it takes, that's what you'll do because otherwise it's insanity. So what are the options? Well, one way to numbness is a soothing behavior. Soothing, not necessarily positive. But you think about it, you know, we know from holding little ones that rocking is soothing, not only to the crying infant, but to the tired parent. Yeah? And so we do rocking, and the infant quiets, and we rest. Well, it's in essence some kind of rhythmic behavior. That's the narcotic. So some abused children rock, some suck their thumbs, some pull out their hair, some masturbate, some pull fur off stuffed animals or tear things or hum a phrase repeatedly or do the things we see that are clearly destructive, like various forms of self-injury, over and over again, over and over again, again and again. I have to make the bad go away. It has to go away. I cannot do this. I have to feel better. Another option is leaving. Not physically, of course, because the child is little, but in the mind. So they find and create another place. For some, it's just blankness. It's like mind paralysis. Nothing happens in there. Everything stops. Freezing. For others, it's a completely different, quite elaborate world where they can go on the inside and be who they no longer are. They can be a safe child. We call it dissociation, which simply means to separate or split. Certainly, rhythmic behavior is often dissociative in nature. You know, people dissociate when they cut. People dissociate when they do all kinds of things. But there are other kinds of leaving, as you know. I recently finished reading a book called The Orphan Master's Son. It was written by a man named Adam Johnson and got a Pulitzer Prize, and it's about North Korea. It's fictional, but it's realistic because it's based on interviews and things. It is frankly a glimpse into hell. The main character dissociates. His torturers at one point say this: he went to a place, some faraway place we could not reach. And the character himself says, in pain school, that's what he called it, I think child sexual abuse would qualify for pain school, they had taught him to find his reserve, a private place he could go in unbearable moments. A pain reserve was like a real reserve. You know, you put a fence around it, you attend to its welfare, you keep it pristine, and you deal harshly with all trespassers. Nobody could know what your pain reserve was, because if you lost it, you would lose everything. That's somebody who dissociates. It gets you away or creates blankness. It creates an oasis. And you see, it actually gives hope, because then you do have in existence a place that is different. It's essentially a narcotic, dissociation, because it stops the pain for a while. And as the years go by, other mechanisms are added. Addictions, which can include good things out of control, like ministry. Protective behaviors, hungry for power, distrust, busyness, emotional distance. You know, if you think about it, addictions are rhythmic behavior. That's all they are. The same thing over and over again. Feel bad or afraid, get a fix. Feel bad or afraid, get a fix. That's what life is controlled by. They're rocking. The problem, of course, is that which separated one from the evil was birthed in evil. And so ultimately, it will not lead to good. If you dissociate whenever you have pain, it means you will never get the source discovered or tended to. If numbness becomes a way of life, you end up with psychological leprosy, which means you'll stick your hand in the fire, and because it's numb, you won't pull it out, and you'll lose your hand. Pain tells us something is wrong and needs tending. Pain causes us to seek help. It tells us there is a problem, but it does not necessarily tell us the source. A pain in your elbow might mean something's wrong with your shoulder. So clients often say to us, well, the pain is here. I've had complex trauma. Clients come to me because they want to know Jesus better. That's the problem on the intake. I've had them come because they have anxiety, or they have depression, or they have marital difficulties. They think the pain is there. They really believe that. But they're not the source. Decades later, the limitations, the distortions, the pain of the abuse can march out into a life in concert and invade intensively, thus bringing someone to our office. And what they want is for the pain to go away and the limitations to end. They don't want to look at the trauma. So how should all of this inform treatment so we do not make unethical responses or judgments, missteps, errors with those who come for help? Been back and forth to Rwanda many times since 2006 to do trainings, and I have learned a great deal from the Rwandans. And there's a wonderful and godly man there who survived the genocide, and a trip or two ago said this to us: we thought we were dead, just animals. They called us cockroaches, you know. But you came. You sat with us, you listened, you saw us, and we remembered we are human. You saw us. And that is what must ever and always underlie the treatment for those who have suffered child sexual abuse or trauma of any kind. Always, no exceptions. You see them, not the other patient you had last year, not where you think they should be, not where you want them to go, no matter how good your goal, not even where they think they should be. You see them, you see who they are, and you see who they were when they were being abused. You must never lose sight of both of those. Who they were still is. The Rwandans were human. I knew that. They did not. And we had to sit with them, with people who thought they were not human. And if we had told them otherwise, it would have been meaningless. Would have gone splat and fallen off. Dignity was restored through sitting and bearing witness at the pace of the wounded person in front of us. And every time you move in to touch the source of the pain, which you must do in this work, it will hurt. And pain from the lightest touch will immediately activate old coping mechanisms, which will prevent treatment from going forward. It can be quite a dilemma if not understood. They come in, they say they want to get better. You share that goal, and you can even see the pathway of how to make it happen. You move forward, they run to their oasis. They go home and cut, or drink, or do a drug, or sleep with six people, or whatever they do. They panic, they resist, they get overwhelmed, they cope badly. The tendency is not to understand this back and forthness in the treatment and to push. You have to face the truth or wrongly urge forward. The result is increasing the need for the oasis, which is destructive. So what does treatment that does not injure look like? Number one, treatment for any injury, let alone a child's shaping energy, must proceed little by little. And again, the trajectory is different for every individual. No Mack truck approaches. None. And I've picked up pieces in a lot of lives where people have, well-intentioned people, done a Mack touch approach. You know, you have to face this truth. Well, actually, no, they do not. They haven't been. They do not want to. You just terrified them and reinforced their desire to run. You have to confront your family. No, they don't. Two, healing from any major injury requires help that is helpful. Because the injury renders the person vulnerable, needy, and dependent. A helper is an assistant who keeps the needs and capacities of the one they are helping in mind. It's no help rehabbing somebody with a broken leg, pushing them to do a marathon in the first week. And even if that's their ultimate goal, learning how to take the next step is the focus. Learning how to take the step well and correctly with the leg aligned is also the focus. Otherwise, the marathon will never come. Number three, healing is repetitious. Wow, look what you just did. Could you do it again? Can you do it 3 times this week? How about 30 times? You're trying to make something go the way it never went before, little by little, over and over. Otherwise, you're going to break or injure something. If you ever, again, you think of physical therapy with something that is misaligned, little by little, over and over, little by little, over and over, that's this work. And if the physical therapist doesn't do that with the body part, they'll break the body part. If you don't do that with a survivor, you'll break the soul. Any of you, again, who've ever been in rehab know what I'm talking about. Move this much, do it correctly, rest, stabilize. Move this much again, do it correctly, rest, stabilize. That's treatment. Four, good treatment includes rest and respite. Again, that's why safety and stabilization is not only the first phase of treatment, but the one most returned to. Because what you're doing is giving them a coping mechanism that is not self-destructive. Therapists often see it as a hindrance to progress. We have to do that again? I thought we already learned that. They fail to see that what it is a reverse of the old pattern. Remember that? Kick, bruise, teach, lies, here it comes again. Now it's stretch a little. Try this. I know it hurts to do that. Can you hold it just for a second? Okay, now let's go over here and rest. Let's talk about something else. Teach truth, rest, stabilize. Teach truth, rest, stabilize. Some clients need more rest than others. Some have less resiliency. Some have greater wounds. Please keep in mind that safety and stabilization, the capacity to rest safely, are gifts that you want them to draw on for the rest of their lives. You teach those skills when you return to it over and over again. You face a lot of resistance in these clients. You need to learn how to work with that resistance and not push against it. You push against resistance, guess what? It's the wrong direction. You need to understand it. There's reasons for them to be afraid. They had reasons then, they have reasons now. So when they are confused or anxious or resistant and say, I can't, the response is, okay, let's honor that. Because again, not reversing the dynamics, they wanted to say, I can't when they were little, and it really didn't matter to the abuser. It needs to matter to you. Let's think together about what you need. What do you need to feel quiet now? What do you need to get stronger? It is not a failure to do this over and over again. It is not a therapeutic failure for the work to be slow. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. It is a strengthening and a supporting, and the client is usually the one who knows what they need, not so much in words, but in behaviors, reactions, resistance, ambivalence. Listen to them. Stop for respite. Breathe. Stabilize. The failure therapeutically is not doing that. 5, both the original trauma injury and treatment result in people feeling more vulnerable. You're in the therapy room, you're the one with the power. They did that with somebody once before, and it didn't turn out very well. People feel little exposed and reduced in our offices. What does that sound like? It sounds like a replication of the trauma dynamic. So when we push too much or too fast, when we fail to understand, and as my Rwandan friend said, we do not see them, we assault them again. Keep in mind that who they were is as much in your presence as who they are. And if you fail to see them, that's what the abuser did. 6, treatment is a 3-legged stool. Safety and stabilization is one of those, rest, respite. And then you get to the scary part, you know, the memories, the feelings that go with the memories, the lies in your head, bit by bit, together revisiting what terrifies them, where they were not seen, where the pain was excruciating and they thought they would die, where the lies rule and they cannot breathe. And then back to safety, a safe oasis with a safe person who sees what was done, who sees how it impacted, and who sees that you need safety. Then, the scary part again, bit by bit, looking at the part that overwhelms, back to safety. So it's safety and stabilization, scary part. Safety and stabilization, scary part. And the third leg is endurance. Not just for the client, but for the therapist. It is a road that is slow and long and full of repetition, a discipline for both people in the room. Frankly, it is a place where God is training two people, not one. Many of the quick fixes that I've seen in the world, therapeutic world, since I began this work in the 1970s, I think have come from therapists who could not, would not endure the repetition, or simply didn't understand that the repetition of the trauma was harmful, no matter how good their intentions. Nor did they see that the slow, repetitive process was needed, and if you rush, you ignore and do not see, you do damage. And perhaps they did not understand that God was and is always working both sides. I have seen many redeemed and transformed lives over the 4 decades that I have done this work, and one of them is mine. So I pray if you do this work, you'll bow to it, because it will require that. 2 things in closing this section. You want to help your clients. I believe that. It's a given for me. Remember these things and see them, who they were and who they are, so you can respond with understanding, not out of your own knowledge, not out of your own experience of abuse, not out of your own needs or plans, not out of your exhaustion that day, not out of your good goals they're nowhere near ready for. Good intentions are not enough. Compassion is not enough. Knowledge is not enough. Good therapy, ethical therapy, as opposed to what I would call malevolent therapy, is therapeutic responses that never repeat the dynamics of the abuse. Good therapy is good for the client always. It is chosen by the client, never forced. And the work we do is verbal, it's word work. We know how to manipulate people. Don't forget. It is truthfully informative. The client is partnered with in decisions, timings, and goals. Kindness, patience, truth, understanding, and faithfulness rule the process. They were never present in the abuse. And finally, I hope you see the utterly incarnational nature of this work. The Word was made flesh and lived with us. He saw us in our ruin. He bore witness to our devastation. He sat with us. He walked with us. He heard us. He calls us to rest. You are following him. You are called in that room behind a closed door to flesh out the Word, to see who sits in front of you, to know and understand so that you can meet them where they are, no matter how ruined. Entering into that place with them so that by your Christ-likeness, which is the reversal of the dynamics of abuse, and your faithful endurance, what you're doing is wooing them out of their sorrow and their night into the freedom-producing truth of God and his great love for them. Yes. Yes. If I could figure all that out, I'd be making more money than the insurance companies. Well, yes, I will, though I do not work with managed care, and, you know, I'm not in one of those places. I see a lot of private pay people, whatever. So I'm in a unique situation. I'm very aware that those are problems for other people. Sometimes, given the limitations of the place that you work and the demands there and the insurance and the financial whatever, the best that you can do is the coping skills that we talked about at the beginning. Because what you're doing is teaching them about the attachment, increasing resiliency, their ability to be competent in their lives and to help them regulate. You may never be able to touch the story. Of course, managed care likes those kinds of things because you can write them down and it's all the language that they prefer. I think that it's very important. I know for therapists who see the work that really needs to be done and can't do it because of such limitations, that that's not only frustrating, but it's heartbreaking. And so you bear a burden because you see and you cannot do. But you can do those coping skills that will strengthen them. And you have to, I think, in the long run, trust them to the God who brought them to you in the first place and where he will lead them in the future. So you may be the person who helped them do these three steps. And it may be 10 years later before somebody comes along and helps them do other part of the work. it's often that we do not work with people from here to here. We work with them here. And we don't even know if this ever happens. I would also add to that, that if the church would understand these issues and raise up caregivers who know how to walk with people, managed care wouldn't win. Because therapists can come in and train, they can come in and teach about these things, they can teach people not how to do this kind of work on this level, but how to care for people and help them with their stories and support them and not judge them and not tell them if they had enough faith they'd be all better by now and everything else. So that is one of the, I believe the church is called to do that work. And I believe that many of you here are either actual or potential trainers of caregivers in the church. And so I think that's the way to supplement what the limitations do. Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, yes, and a healthy seed, somebody will water it. Yes. Yes. Yes, the roots of this are trauma. If you let me do this work, you won't have to pay for the hospital again. Yes, absolutely. Some of them will listen. Not all of them. Yes.
This is kind of like a question, comment about, the early 80s, we saw this flurry of preschools, all over the United States that, were sexually abused kids, at Martin School in Manhattan Beach, sort of was in the forefront. And, then we suddenly swing back with the pendulum of all this repressed memory and research on eyewitnesses and, memory is so controversial, especially in our literature, and I guess I'm wanting to know your vision of, because finally we're talking more about trauma. Mm-hmm. We're really standing up to the fact that, yes, something really did happen, and having worked with kids in one area, just weaving through the court process, kids are heartbreaking.
Yes.
We're finally just settling in now. How the pendulum swings,
yes.
Hysterical about all these kids being abused, and then suddenly, well, these kids don't know the truth about it. I mean, what are your thoughts on where we're going now?
Well, let me say a couple of things before I answer that particular question. One is, again, I've done this work for 40 years. I have never had a client who came to therapy without memories. Just for the record, that's a lot of people. I've had two who lied all over the place. It was pretty obvious, but two's not very many. All the other people I have seen have come with memories, and probably 90% of them had something to corroborate, a sibling's testimony, school records, physical records, whatever. So I tend to treat such things as credible. But in the 80s, nobody knew anything about how to interview children. I mean, that's why we have mandated reporting, because we don't know how to interview children in terms of these things unless we've been trained specifically. So people interview the way a parent does, which is to plant stuff. Then the question leads the child. So there was abominable stuff going on back then, but a lot of it was based on ignorance. There was also crazy stuff going on in terms of abuse and stuff from the book Courage to Heal that was out. And, if you have these symptoms, you've been abused whether you know it or not, and you should confront your abuser whether you know it or not. And, I mean, it was really bad stuff. So it was a baby field. I mean, The fact of the matter is that nobody wants to talk about incest. So now we're talking about things like incest and rape and all that kind of thing. But we're having to learn how to talk about it, how to investigate it, how to interview about it, how to treat it. And we've learned a lot in the last few decades, but we have a long way to go. So I think that we, you know, one of the things I believe in for all therapists is consult, consult, consult. And then when you've done that, consult some more. Because so much of what we do alone. And nobody really sees. And so you need to constantly be in consultation with others, you know, because it's very easy, particularly when you get to things that are this heavily emotion-laden and all kinds of things. You need to have other voices in your life to help you because it's very easy to get off track, very easy to start pushing on something for the good of the client, very easy to interview in a way that leads rather than just asks and waits, so and accepts the answer, whatever it is. So I think a lot of humility and caution and consultation and things like that will protect us as we go ahead. And then there's much more research coming out in places like Harvard and things like that about memory and how the body's impacted and things like that. We need to be up to date on what's out there, which will probably change in 10 years. Anybody else? Yes.
You mentioned a few books. Do you recommend for your clients to read any particular books you like for them to read? Of course, everybody Googles everything these days.
Yes. Yes. She asked about books for clients to read and things like that. I do not recommend books for clients to read in the first phase. Because if they don't know how to regulate themselves, they're going to go home and get triggered, and I'm not going to be there to help them, and they won't know how to help themselves. So I'm really cautious about that. I've had clients who've read On the Threshold of Hope that I wrote, which is for victims, but I will often say to them, first of all, it's later in treatment. Second of all, it has really short chapters, and the book tells them only to read one chapter at a time. So they come in and say, well, I read the whole book last night between the hours of 12 and 3, doing exactly what you told me not to do, and you were right. So sometimes, when I know somebody's probably likely to do that, I say, how about, I figure it's okay since it's my book, how about I copy the chapter, and you take it home, and you can't have any more than that. Because I don't want them to get dysregulated, because it sets us back, and they feel like a failure and everything else. I ask, you can't keep some people, they get so anxious, they Google everything, and then they come in and they're, you know, bipolar and schizophrenic and DID and everything else all at one time, and I ask them not to do that. And I ask them, not so much because there can't be good information online, of course there can be, but it agitates them and dysregulates them. So what we're trying to do is not do those things, at least for a while. So I'm very cautious about those things. Anybody else? Okay, let's just look for a few minutes at some of the ethical papers that you have for me in your handout. I just want to go over a couple of them. Again, you're literate. You can read them. Guidelines for memory work. Some of these I've already said multiple times, so hopefully you've already heard them. That's true about number one, no set of symptoms. Number two, not all child sexual abuse is traumatic, which is something we did assume a few decades ago. If you had child sexual abuse happen one time for 10 minutes, you had PTSD. Well, actually, that's not true. So, you know, it's traumatic when you have symptoms of a traumatic disorder, trauma disorder. Three, you cannot adamantly tell a client you know they were sexually abused when they have no memory of it. I can't tell you how many people have done that. Well, you have all these symptoms and indicators. I believe that the problem is that you were sexually abused. Well, I don't know, I wasn't sexually abused. I have no memory of it. Well, you just haven't found it yet or something. That still happens. And you are not the judge of whether it was traumatic or not. You can't say, well, if that happened to you, then you have trauma. Not necessarily. So we have to resist the urge to pronounce. We can make pronouncements sometimes as therapists. It's generally not a wise thing to do. it is the client's right and privilege to tell you whether or not they were sexually abused. Even if they were sexually abused for 15 years of their life and they don't want to tell you, that's their prerogative. So we have to honor that choice. And if somebody pretty much tells me they were but they don't want to talk about it, you know, I will explore why. And I might even say, you know, I suspect that's probably affecting your life. I'd love to be able to help you with that. But it's your life, it's your memory, and it's your choice. Most of the time, they'll come back around again. Sometimes they'll terminate and come back a year later. Sometimes they'll come back the next session, whatever. But it's their choice what to do with the memory, with their lives, whatever, with their treatment. Non-leading questions. We have to be very careful, you know, and people ask questions again, you know, well, my father sexually abused me, blah, blah, blah. There were some other people, I don't really remember who. Well, do you think your grandfather was one of them? That's a leading question. You don't do that. You know, well, we'll give it some time. And I work a lot, you know, 90% of the people I see come from the evangelical community. So, you know, part of what I will often say to them when they're worried about truth is, look, the God of truth is in the room. He doesn't want you to believe something that's not true. I don't either. You don't. So if you think of something and you're not sure if it's true or not and you want to tell me, you can give me that caveat. You know, I think I remember this, but I don't really know if it really happened. Okay, we'll put it over here in a different pile. Don't pronounce or ask leading questions or whatever. Again, it's our primary responsibility to offer clinical excellence, ethical practices, and a safe context for our clients. And I really, you know, our work should be governed by caution, which is based in humility and respect. I've done this work for 40 years, and the next time a survivor walks into my office, I won't know who she is or what the story is or who he is or what happened to him and how it impacted. And yes, I have general knowledge from 40 years' experience, but I cannot presume that that fits that person, ever. And so oftentimes, as we get sort of inured to the work, we've done it a long time. This can happen in any field, not just with trauma, but we think we know. We know what depression is. You don't know what theirs is. And so we always have to maintain that place of humility. I know some things. I probably know some things they don't know, I hope. But I don't know their story and what it was like for them. And they're the only ones who can tell me that. And they get to tell me, and they get to tell me in their time at their speed. So it's the caution based in humility and respect for the person and honoring their freedom of choice in the process and everything else, because the person who sits in front of you is a human being created in the image of God who has been squashed. And you want to not squash, you want to help God resurrect in the way that you treat them. You want to look like him enough that he can resurrect in them all of those image-bearing qualities that got squashed. Statements that reflect substandard practices. This particular handout and Appendix A, Risk Management Checklist, which I'm not going to read, were created by a man named Sam Knapp, who's a psychologist and has been a real gift to me and those in my practice. He's worked for the Pennsylvania Psychological Association for a really long time. And his advice on very complicated ethical issues and how to handle them has just been a godsend for many years. Because no matter how long you do this, every once in a while somebody will come in and you go, oh my goodness, I have no clue what to do. So I call Sam. So he wrote this book, Treating Patients with Memories of Abuse, quite some time ago, obviously. But there are some good things in it. So these are statements that reflect substandard practices. And again, these are very common statements still today. You have the symptoms of somebody who was abused. Studies show that, my experience is that most people who have this, whatever, were sexually abused. Those are all leading things. If you think you were abused, you probably were. Really? I mean, we work with all kinds of people who think something happened that didn't happen. This person is mad at me, this person looked funny at me, this person doesn't like me, and it turns out not to be true. Why would we assume that would be true? Remembering is essential if you want to be healed. No, it's not. And I believe that that is God's governance, that territory. There are ways that he works with people that are different than this whole layout. And so people will say, I only remember this, but I know there was more and I don't remember it, and so I'll never get better. No. God is not limited by your memory to transform you. Now, he will use truth. But you don't have to remember every detail in order to be healed. This technique, and this happens, you know, these are the oftentimes quick fix things or whatever. You know, if I hypnotize you, we do guided imagery, we do this, we do that, it'll help you remember. It's not your job to help them remember. It's your job to respond to what they do remember or not. Number six, suing, which doesn't generally happen in the Christian world, forgiving does. You know, you have to forgive this person. Well, actually, they don't have to anything. There's a whole section in Counseling Survivors on forgiveness, but there's been a whole lot in the Christian world that has really been damaging to survivors, as if, number one, if you forgive, you'll be all better. Well, that isn't true. And people can't forgive if they don't know what they're forgiving for. How do you forgive a sin? You don't even know what to call it. And people will do that like it's a magic pill so they can be right with God and not have to do the work. So we have to be very careful in, yes, do I think forgiving is of God? Absolutely. He says it is. He says he does that in us for others so we look like him. But it's later in the process because you're forgiving not only the abuse but the impact and the way it shaped your life and all the things it took from you. That's a lot to forgive. And it's usually an ongoing process, not just an act that makes it all better. Number seven, you have to get worse before you get better. A lot of people say that. And in the sense of being disturbed by the memories and things, I understand where that comes from. But if you do the safety and stabilization and you teach these coping skills and you teach regulation and all that kind of stuff, actually, that's not true. You can help them develop a sense of competency while they face the thing they were most afraid to look at. Your body holds accurate memories of these past events. No, that's not true. People talk about body memories. Yes, abuse impacts the body. Yes, we have symptoms in our bodies, often when we don't have words. One of the things we see a lot in Rwanda are conversion disorders, which you see very rarely here. Children who were in the genocide have ridiculous amounts of epilepsy, which when they do the scans and everything, there's no epilepsy at all. I spoke with an ophthalmologist some years ago, and he had a woman he was treating who came in. Genocide lasted for 100 days. She's blind for 100 days. He says, there's nothing the matter with her eyes. But the first day it began, and the last day it ended, and then she can see again. Well, she doesn't want to see. You know, so yes, the body can say things that way. But what happened early on, and I find still happens with therapists, is they talk about body memories like the body can tell you exactly what happened and who did it and how it happened and all those things. The body can't talk like that. Your mouth talks like that. And so we have to be very careful with that. We have to be up on the research and understand the impact on the body, particularly of chronic trauma and what that does, and how the symptoms in the body are ways where the memory is alive and it's coming out physically, like this woman being blind. But the blindness in this woman doesn't tell me what she saw and couldn't see. And that's where we need to go. So we have to be very careful with those kinds of things. Okay. I think, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just do one quick thing, and then we'll stop for a break again. And then we're going to look at the spiritual impact of trauma, and we're going to look at grief and how to lament, because I think that's a huge thing for survivors. And then at the very end, we're going to do the vicarious trauma thing. But let me just close this section briefly by saying, you know, there is a third phase of treatment, which is actually quite a lovely phase, because you've got the safety and stabilization, you've got the coping skills that are really regulating, and there's competency there and all of that. You've done the work together of looking at the bulk of the memories, not just the memories themselves, but their impact on the person, the lies that have been carried in the head, and govern the life, issues of shame, if there was a desire and a need at the appropriate time to confront the issues of forgiveness and all of that, and a lot of the grief work. So most of that part is done. And phase three is about today. Phase three is a lot about their relationship with God, because now that they've looked at the abuse, they want to look at God and see what to do with those two things that don't go together in their head. It's about relationships in if they're married. It often involves some marital work. If I work with a survivor who's married and the husband is a safe person, which they aren't always, I will periodically have him in or have him see an associate or somebody to teach him about abuse and how to respond and all of those things so he can help ground at home and things like that. And then when you get to phase three, you begin to rework the marital relationship because he woke up married to somebody different. Friendships, church relationships. I find phase three is also where survivors are really rethinking even careers, certainly their gifting. Many of them go back to school, completely change what they do with their lives. So it's a time of transition and things like that. They begin to have a vision for their future, which is something they never had, which is quite lovely. And they also begin to look for ways as they struggle through their relationship with God, how to make meaning out of their suffering. Is there a way that God might use what I've lived through? Most survivors that I see want to grow up and do what I do. By the time they get to phase three, that dwindles down to quite a little number. But it's the direct way of seeing God using their own suffering, and that they can see that because they have a concrete experience of it. And some of them do grow up to do what I do, and some of them are very fine therapists and things like that. But phase three is about who am I, which they never got to ask as a kid. What are my gifts? What do I love? What brings me joy? And how might God use those things in the world? And how might he inform what I do through my own suffering and what I've learned about him to bless others? So they're wonderful questions. And people are often, begin to develop the use of their gifts within their own churches, sometimes in nonprofits that work overseas and things like that. But there's often a helping component to what they do, whether it's earning a living that way or whether it's volunteer work. And then in terms of terminating with people, I titrate. You do this work with somebody from beginning to end, which I have had the privilege of doing with many people, you become a rather important figure in their lives. And actually, they become quite important to you as well. And so, people go from phase two to phase three to every week to every other week, whatever, once a month. And then somebody says, well, I think I need to. Okay, so we try 3 months, and then we check in, and then we try 3 months again, maybe, and then we try six, and then a year later they come in and see me. Some people call it their 1,000-mile checkup or something. And then eventually they go. Not from here. but it's never, and as much as can be helped in terms of circumstances and everything, it's never an abrupt thing, because you have that central place in the development of the self and the one person who knows the full story and who went there and bore witness and things like that. So you end up having a very unique place in their lives, which will not be changed even if you never see them again. But eventually they go and they do their lives and I get notes and it's quite wonderful. So it is a work that is a great privilege to do, a work that has taught me a great deal about who God is with us. Okay, I think we're a little early, but can we take a break anyway? Are we allowed to fudge the clock? And we'll come back and do the spiritual impact.